You do education and enlightenment such that everyone who's part of this deliberative process has a basic level of the science, the economics, and the policies of climate change, and you're able to get a population sufficiently well-educated about the issues, sufficiently representatives of the world, of the population of the world, to be part of a negotiation. And it's been done before. It was first done 2 years ago, I think, or 3 years ago at COP, and now there's going to be a track to integrate these kinds of citizen-based assembly as part of COP negotiation, which I think is a positive development.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bonnie Ibawa is a legal historian. He teaches global human rights in the Department of History and the Center for Global Peace, Justice, and Health at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He's the founding director of the McMaster Center for Human Rights and Restorative Justice, a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, and current chair of the United Nations Expert Mechanism on the Right to Development. Learn more about Bonnie Ibawa's work and the quest for climate justice at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post our complete conversation with Bonnie Ibawa right there. The Chagos Islands, not a place many people have heard of, much less visited. You can barely find them on a map. In the middle of the Indian Ocean, just south of the southern tip of India, long before Europeans arrived, the Chagos Islands were culturally tied to the island of Mauritius, due east of Madagascar. The Dutch arrived in Mauritius in the 17th century. In the mid-18th century, the French seized it. The British seized it from the French at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. In 1968, Mauritius gained its independence from Britain with one small cutout, the Chagos Islands. The largest island in the archipelago, Diego Garcia, would be the perfect place to set up a military base, due south of the oil-rich Persian Gulf, in cahoots with the Pentagon. That's exactly what Britain did. Diego Garcia would become a shining star in the ever-expanding constellation of U.S. military bases all around the planet. Also, a great dark site where official enemies of the U.S. could be imprisoned, tortured, and so on. The Chagosians were forcibly displaced in the cruelest of ways. In the early 2000s, Mauritius took Britain to the International Court of Justice, the international community's supreme judicial body. In February 2019, the ICJ issued an advisory opinion. The process of decolonization of Mauritius was not lawfully completed when that country acceded to independence, the court opined. The Chagosian people's right to self-determination had been violated, it went on. The UK's administration of their island home is an internationally wrongful act, and the UK must end its administration of the archipelago as rapidly as possible. The United Nations General Assembly endorsed the ICJ ruling shortly thereafter, calling on all UN member states to secure Chagosian independence by November 2025. That's just late last year. Colonialists to the core and the tightest of U.S. allies, Britain said, sure, then hedged its bets. It struck a deal with Mauritius. Under the terms of that deal, ostensibly aimed at advancing the ICJ ruling, Mauritius would lease Diego Garcia to the UK for 99 years with a possible 40-year extension. A very long story that David Vine has been following for years. Vine is a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. We reached David Vine in Oakland, California. How many Chagosians were expelled from the Chagos Archipelago and from Diego Garcia back in between 65 and 68? And How many of them were there back then, and how many of them are there today? And what was that expulsion like? Like, what exactly happened?
There were, at the time, between 900 and 1,000 Chagossians living on Diego Garcia, and there were somewhere between 500 and 1,000 living on the other islands in the archipelago. The people were removed in a process between 1968 and 1973. First, the British government began restricting supplies to the islands, food and medical supplies, and withdrawing some of the medical personnel and other staff on the islands. Conditions on the islands began declining. And when Chagossians left the islands for regular vacations, they were living and working on coconut plantations, and had been since their arrival on the islands, or their ancestors' arrival. This was not a materially wealthy life, but as one Chagossian who I interviewed years and years ago, I've been working on the issue for almost 25 years. One of the Chagossians put it to me, this was the sweet life. It wasn't a rich life in material terms, but it was the sweet life, a life they controlled. They had guaranteed employment, guaranteed salaries and food and cash, and guaranteed vacations. And when Chagossians left for an annual vacation to travel to Mauritius, British government agents simply prevented them from going home. They said, your island has been sold, it's been closed, you can't go back. Meanwhile, there were still Chagossians living there. And with time, the British government, at the order of U.S. government officials, forcibly rounded up all the Chagossians, first living on Diego Garcia in 1971, and herded them onto overcrowded cargo ships in a series of trips, and deported them 1,200 miles away to Seychelles and Mauritius, leaving them on the docks with no resettlement assistance. And the process then continued to the other islands in 1972 and 1973. And by 1973, all the Chagossians had been dumped in exile. I should note that in 1971, as part of the deportations from Diego Garcia, the British government agents on the island, aided by U.S. naval personnel who were there beginning to build the base, rounded up all the Chagossians' pet dogs and proceeded to gas them with exhaust from U.S. Navy vehicles in sealed cargo sheds. Gas them to death, that is, and then burn their carcasses in front of the Chagossians, as Chagossians were awaiting their deportation. And as one Chagossian lawyer put it, this sent a pretty strong message to Chagossians about what might happen if they resisted their deportation. We're on the verge of the Chagossians winning some measure of justice and being able to go back, at least initially, to all their islands except Diego Garcia, and to receive some amount of compensation, £40 million, which is a pittance ultimately. It would translate into a few thousand pounds per person. They're now somewhere around probably 8,000 Chagossians, including those born in exile. But the number of Chagossians who were born on the islands, who by and large just want to go home and die on their islands of their birth, the place where their ancestors are buried, their numbers are dwindling in the few hundreds. So there is great urgency to allow them to go home, and to allow them to go home to all their islands, including Diego Garcia. There's no good reason why Chagossians can't go back to Diego Garcia. Civilian populations live next to U.S. military bases around the world, including Guantanamo Bay. There's a Cuban population across the fence line. Cubans, actually some still work on the base, and formerly many worked on the base, commuting there on a daily basis. But there are civilian populations living near U.S. bases around the world, and Chagossians can and should be able to live on Diego Garcia with the base there, including on half of the island that isn't even used by the base. It's across a lagoon on the right side of a V-shaped island.
What do we know about the health and socioeconomic status of Chagossians before their expulsion and what impact the expulsion had on their health status, on their broader socioeconomic status, all kinds of indicators of wellness. What impact did this have on a population that I presume, you know, at the turn of the century, you know, in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s was probably doing really well?
This was the first thing that I investigated. I was initially asked by lawyers representing Chagossians in lawsuits against the British and U.S. governments to conduct some research documenting the effects of the expulsion on their lives. And this included documenting what their health and overall well-being was before the expulsion. And initially, this was for a report for the lawyers, and then I expanded my research for a PhD dissertation, and then a book, Island of Shame, detailing their history in the archipelago and their history since, including their struggle to return home. Chagossians, research shows, enjoyed generally quite good health in the archipelago. These are beautiful tropical islands. They had free access to extensive seafood, coconuts. They had regular supplies of any vegetables and other grains and lentils that they needed. They enjoyed a healthy diet and healthy living conditions in a number of respects, living in the islands, that is. After the expulsion, living in exile, their lives declined and deteriorated in a number of ways. They were impoverished in a number of ways, impoverished in a material sense. Their economic lives cratered. They had guaranteed employment before the expulsion, and in exile, they had no jobs and were actually plunged into life in Mauritius and the Seychelles, where unemployment was incredibly high and where they had skills that weren't perfectly suited for Mauritius and the Seychelles. They had skills that were perfectly suited for the coconut plantations they had been living on and working on for generations. And in Mauritius and the Seychelles, they, by and large, became the poorest of the poor, the lowest of the low in both societies. And their physical health, and as well as their mental health, declined dramatically. My research, including quantitative and qualitative research and a large survey of Chagossians in Mauritius and the Seychelles and a few other places where a diaspora had formed, showed that very high rates of alcoholism and addiction to drugs, as well as other indicators of poor health across multiple realms.
And over these years following the expulsion, did a movement to return to the Chagos Islands emerge amongst the Chagossian people? Did a national liberation and a return to the homeland movement rise up?
Indeed, there was protest from the beginning when it was announced on Diego Garcia that it was announced, when British government agents announced with U.S. Navy personnel in the background that Chagossians had no choice but to get on overcrowded cargo ships that some have compared to slave ships. They were so crowded and the conditions were so awful. Chagossians protested and said, this is our home, this is our country, this is our island. We do not want to leave, but they were given no choice. And in exile, Chagossians similarly protested and demanded to be returned to their islands and to get proper compensation for the harms committed against them, for the crimes committed against them. And that protest movement has taken the form of hunger strikes, protests in the streets of Mauritius in particular, and lawsuits against the British and U.S. governments, lawsuits that in Britain in particular won some tremendous victories, including three victories in the High Court in London, that unfortunately the British government appealed on every occasion and ultimately won in the highest court in Britain, the House of Lords, and later the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom.
When was that?
These lawsuits began in the late 1990s, and it was a long saga that continued into the last decade. But the International Court of Justice ruling that you referenced was the greatest victory for the Chagosians to date, when they effectively allied with the government of Mauritius. You need to be a nation state, to bring a case to the International Court of Justice. And that is what Mauritius did. There are really two crimes here. There's the crime of expulsion and exile that the US and British governments committed against the Chagosians. And then there's the crime that the US and British governments committed against the government and people of Mauritius by effectively stealing the Chagos Islands from Mauritius during the decolonization process, a theft that was explicitly unlawful, illegal under international law. You couldn't chop up colonies at that point when you were granting them independence if you were a colonial power. And that is precisely what the British government did at the advice of the US government. So this is what the Mauritian government took the British government to the International Court of Justice to claim, as and successfully, that the separation of the Chagos Islands from the rest of Mauritius was illegal. And indeed, the International Court of Justice found overwhelmingly that that was the case. The United Nations General Assembly later followed up the ruling with the instructions to complete the decolonization of Mauritius by returning sovereignty formally to Mauritius and by assisting Chagosians in returning to their homeland.
And it's interesting, this May 22nd bilateral agreement between the UK and Mauritius, ostensibly aimed at implementing the advisory opinion, calls for the leasing of Diego Garcia to the UK for 99 years with a possible 40-year extension. And this is a pending domestic ratification in both Mauritius and, I presume, the UK. It's pretty outrageous, it would seem to me. And what's on that base? Like, comment on that, but what's there? What's on Diego Garcia? What kind of hardware, military hardware, and surveillance equipment does the United States, do the United States and Great Britain maintain there on Diego Garcia?
So I would just say that the treaty is deeply problematic in a few respects, beginning with the bar on Chagosians being able to return to Diego Garcia. It allows them to go back to all their other islands, but not to Diego Garcia. And this is a violation of their rights to self-determination, their right to return to their homeland and live in their homeland, violation of multiple internationally recognized rights. It also doesn't allow them to work on the island, which some of them would like to do. The treaty also provides for only £40 million in a kind of compensation to Chagosians. It doesn't really guarantee them any rights to oversee that £40 million trust fund or any other rights to consultation or democratic participation in future negotiations about their islands. On the other hand, the treaty does guarantee to Mauritius, and you can see why they have, in part, you can see why they have given up effective sovereignty rights over Diego Garcia to the UK and de facto to the United States as well, because they're getting more than £3 billion over 99 years in exchange for giving up those sovereignty rights over Diego Garcia. And that comes in the form of a couple different funds. So there are a number of ways in which I desperately hope, and many Chagosians also hope, that the two governments, at the advice of in several UN government bodies, improve the treaty before it comes into effect, beginning with allowing Chagosians to go back to Diego Garcia and live on Diego Garcia, and if they want to work on the base, to work on the base, beginning with Chagosian right to democratic participation in all future negotiations and conversations between the governments over Diego Garcia, and some real proper compensation for all the crimes committed against Chagosians. And the Mauritian government should also guarantee that the $1.125 billion in development funds promised under the treaty, $1.125 billion over 25 years that the UK will pay to Mauritius, the Mauritian government has promised privately to dedicate that money to resettle the islands, rebuild the infrastructure necessary to allow Chagossians to go home. They need to put that in writing, that all that money will go to helping to resettle Chagossians in their homeland.
So the UK administers, Diego Garcia administers, quote unquote, but it's an American base that's there. Perhaps it's a joint US-American base, but I'm sure that Diego Garcia, for, you know, Pete Hegseth, is the, you know, the jewel and the crown of America's, the United States' kind of constellation of 800 military bases around the world. There are few, perhaps the one in Qatar, that big air base in Qatar, but the one in Diego Garcia is really a really pivotal spot for the U.S. military, isn't it?
This is what is frequently claimed. The base on Diego Garcia is frequently claimed to be essential to national security for the U.S., for the U.K. And my simple response to anyone who makes such claims is prove it. How is an island thousands of miles from the nearest U.S. and U.K. border essential to national security? It is not. In fact, it is indeed much prized by people in the military and other U.S. and British government officials, but it's prized because it has been a launch pad for war, the wars that have by and large been catastrophic for the U.S. and for the U.K., wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, far beyond. More recently, the base has been used to threaten Iran. The base has been used to increasingly to threaten China. So it's playing a role in increasing tensions that could lead to a what should be a completely unthinkable war between the United States and China, among other potential wars that the Trump administration or any future administration might launch.
And what's there? What's on Diego Garcia?
Well, in part, we don't know. In addition to Chagossians being barred from Diego Garcia for more than half a century, journalists and human rights investigators have been barred from going there since the early 1980s, with rare exception. I think in the past several years, a couple journalists have managed to get to Diego Garcia, but with very strict restrictions on their ability to see what is there. But as far as we know, it's a major U.S. Air Force and Navy base. There's a NASA presence, an NSA presence, CIA presence. Most people assume there are nuclear weapons on the base. In many ways, clearly the U.S. military enjoys its isolation and enjoys having no civilian population it has to worry about, enjoys not having to worry about surveillance in the way that it might elsewhere, among other kinds of intrusion that it feels might be subject to.
And it is a hub for global surveillance and intelligence operations, signals intelligence, signals capturing, global monitoring of what's going on around the planet. I mean, it's right in the middle of the of nowhere with no kind of electromagnetic interference, you know, pointing up to the skies to all those military satellites. It's got its eyes on the skies all around the world here in Diego Garcia.
Indeed. You know, again, most of the details of that surveillance are classified. But again, what we know more clearly is that they're all the most powerful aircraft in the Air Force's arsenal. B-2, B-52, B-1 bombers have been based there. The Navy can bring an aircraft carrier task force to the island. There are permanently stationed pre-positioned ships, each one the size of the Empire State Building, that are stocked with Marine Corps weaponry, tanks, everything for a Marine Corps brigade. And those pre-positioned ships have been used on multiple occasions to invade, for example, Iraq. They arrived on the borders of Iraq more quickly than pre-positioned ships and other vessels coming from the United States.
Are they going to win their case, the Chagossians, the people of Diego Garcia, David Vine? Are they heading back to Diego Garcia? And I note here the International Court of Justice said in its advisory opinion in February of 2019, quote, all member states are under obligation to cooperate in completing the decolonization of Mauritius, namely by assisting in the return of the Chagossians to Diego Garcia. So what are the prospects for Chagossians to return, and what would you like to see the international community doing to make this happen?
This January, we should know. We should know if this historic victory that Chagossians are due will come into effect. We should know if Chagossians can go back to all their islands, or initially to all their islands except Diego Garcia. If Chagossians can, or the ban on their returning to Diego Garcia remains in place, I can assure you Chagossians will continue their struggle to go back there. They will not be content with going to all their other islands. So their struggle will very much continue, as well as their struggle for proper compensation and reparations for the damage, the crimes committed against them. But we should know this month if the beginnings of some measure of justice are won by Chagossians. And of course, my hope is that comes to pass with the help of other UN member states putting pressure on the UK and the US and the Mauritian governments to do the right thing and finally bring Chagossians some measure of justice after far too long that they have been suffering in exile.
David Vine, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor, and we shall link to your various books about American military power, power projection, and its network of bases around the world at the Green Planet Monitor.
David, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you again.
David Vine is a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a trilogy of books about the U.S. penchant for permanent war and about America's network of 800 military bases around the world. Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia, was published in 2011. All royalties from Vine's book go to the Chagossian people. The latest of David Vine's books, published in 2020 by University of California Press, is entitled The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. It's a great read. Listen to and watch my complete conversation with David Vine at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net and cfmu.ca. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly one in four people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.